Hello, listeners and viewers. Welcome to another episode on Rising Above Shadows of Abuse, RASA, where we discuss issues relating to abuse, mental health, culture, and society. I'm your host, Grace Upper. Today's episode centers around world news reels on abuse. The first story is from Metro News by Josh Milton, 29th of April, 2024. A woman who suffered a head injury so deep it reached her skull had no idea what had happened until a nurse said the four-letter words to her, "Your boyfriend did it." Emily Lewis, 24, was beaten and strangled by Thomas Jones, her boyfriend of 3 years, who was high on cocaine and alcohol. The woman from Neath, Wales, suffered an 8-centimeter long and 4-centimeter wide head injury, a fractured cheekbone, and was left covered in bruises. The attack, which happened overnight between February the 18th and 19th last year, left Emily needing 19 stitches. She said, "During our relationship, he was never massively aggressive to me. In the year leading up to it, I thought he had a drinking problem because he would go out all the time and come home late and then have a go at me. There were traits of negative behavior towards me, but nothing like this. I wouldn't have described it as a toxic relationship. Yet on February the 18th, 2023, the couple went with friends to Wynne Street in the heart of Swansea scene, only for Jones to get kicked out of a venue. He was calling me names, a cunt, telling me to F off and telling me to go away while I was trying to diffuse the situation," Emily said. "He went into another place and he got kicked out of there. The pair returned home. Emily had no memory of what happened after they closed the front door. I remember being inside the house and I remembered him strangling me to the point where I couldn't breathe," she said. "I could feel myself drifting in and out of consciousness. I was trying to kick him off me, but I'm small compared to him, so I wasn't able to." She added, "While I was on the floor, he was punching me repeatedly to the point where I was in so much pain, I told him to kill me because I couldn't take it anymore. I was hurting everywhere. He had battered me all over." Swansea's Crown Court heard how Emily phoned her mom 10 times to help her. When she arrived, Jones punched her in the face as she took her daughter to Morriston Hospital. Waking up in a hospital room the following morning in absolute agony, Emily said she realized the extent of her injuries after looking at her mobile phone camera. "My head was shaved. I had stitches in my head and my face was swollen up like a balloon," Emily said. "I threw my phone because I was in so much shock and I didn't know who did it. I asked the nurse and she told me it was my boyfriend. I was shocked and traumatized when I found out he did this. My life completely changed in one night. The day before, we were fine, and now I haven't spoken to him since." Seeing the mirror now brings Emily right back to the morning, seeing her bloodied and bruised face for the first time since the attack. Ammonia is something she is trying to live with. Emily still bears the scar from the gash she sustained on her head. One prosecutor suggested it was caused by the screen of an Alexa found shattered and splattered with blood. In a victim statement read directly to Jones, Emily said, "I am a survivor. I have a scar that reminds me of how strong I will become. You haven't taken away my will to live. You haven't broken my spirit. This scar is a constant reminder of what happened, but it does not define my future. I can't bear the thought of this happening to someone else." Jones was sentenced to 18 months behind bars on April the 22nd. He was also handed a two-month term to run concurrently for battery following his actions towards Emily's mother. He will serve half the sentence in prison before being released on license. A restraining order will also prevent him from contacting Emily for 3 years. Judge Thomas told the defendant, "This offense is simply too serious to justify anything other than immediate custody. A message has to go out to people, particularly men, that prison will be the inevitable outcome." What are your thoughts on this particular newsreel? Do you think he was given an adequate sentence? It would have been more. What would have warranted such battery from Jones on Emily, his girlfriend he's been dating for 3 years? Do you think the attack was fueled by drug and alcohol? Kindly let me know your views, your thoughts about this particular newsreel via email address risingaboveshadowsofabuse@gmail.com. Thank you. The 3rd of April 2024, BBC News by Bethram Hill, Ada Miller, and Michael Sikin. BBCI Investigations. BBCI investigates a secret document that alleges the teen protester was molested and killed by Iranian security forces. According to an alleged official document leaked to the BBC, an Iranian teenager was sexually assaulted and killed by Iranian security forces. Nika's Last Breath, a documentary by BBC Art, premiered today as part of BBC World Service Presents, scrutinizes the confidential document and maps the final movement of 16-year-old Shakarami after she vanished during the anti-government protests in September 2020. Nika Shakarami attended a Woman Life freedom protest in Tehran that day. Pictures taken of her burning hijabs made her an icon in the eyes of Iran's protesters and a target in the eye of the Iranian government. Nika never went home. Her family found her body in a mortuary more than a week after she disappeared. Iran's authorities denied Nika's death was connected to the demonstration and, after conducting their own investigation, said that she had died by suicide after jumping from a building. Her mother, Nasreen Shakarami, never accepted it. Now, a purported official document has been leaked to the BBC saying the teenager was sexually assaulted and killed by undercover agents working for Iran's security forces. In Nika's Last Breath, BBCI investigates this shocking report, believed to be written by the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, which says she was hunted down, sexually assaulted, and bludgeoned to death. The leaked document, a summary of a five-hour hearing held by the IRGC into Nika Shakarami's case, includes what it says are the names of her alleged killers and the senior commanders who tried to hide the truth. The BBC spent months checking every detail in it with multiple sources. The BBC Eye documentary details the extensive verification process undertaken by the production team, indicating the papers obtained by the BBC do chronicle the teenagers in Nika's last breath, grueling documentary evidence, striking animation, as well as drama are all brought together to reconstruct the last hours of the 16-year-old Nika Shakorami. Evidence presented by the BBC indicates that her death wasn't a suicide, as officially claimed by the Iranian authorities. It was a killing. BBC I put the report's allegations to the Iranian government. They did not respond. Nika's Last Breath from the BBC World Service is available for viewing in the UK via BBC iPlayer and internationally on the BBC World Service YouTube channel. Read the story on the BBC News website via the bbc.co.uk in the UK and internationally on bbc.com, BBC Studios Global Digital News Platform. Nika's Last Breath is produced and directed by Bertrand Hill and Ada Miller. What are your thoughts about this particular newsreel? The government covering the assault, rape, sexual violence, as well as the murder of their own citizen, a 16-year-old teenager, by government forces. These forces are meant to be protecting their citizens. Unfortunately, that is not the case. And there is no accountability. What do you think about this news here? In comments, your thoughts, by email address, risingupofshadowsofabuse@gmail.com. Thank you. Evening Standard. Next newsreel is from the Evening Standard, 29th of April 2024. Two men who filmed 6,000 people in bathrooms and swimming pool changing rooms. Yeah. Story by Lydia Chandler Hicks. Two men who secretly photographed thousands of people at swimming pools in London and southwest England have been jailed. Robert Morgan, 32, and Adams Dennis, 38, are understood to have filmed and photographed roughly 6,000 people, including children, without their consent, as they used changing rooms and bathrooms. The two men came to the attention of police because of a separate investigation into an assault, which happened on board a train in March 20. A mobile phone was seized by officers investigating the assault, and the two men were arrested for voyeurism offences in November 2017. Forensic examination of items seized from the men's homes showed covert filming of victims while they used the bathroom, and images of victims in changing rooms, cubicles. Online chats show the pair sharing and trading images of victims from common phone changing rooms and creating profiles of them. The investigation flagged at least 6,000 potential victims. Detectives say a large number of photographs are unidentified. British transport police officers have been able to trace the number of victims from who were children at the time of the footage being captured to inform them of an investigation. None of the victims police have spoken to were aware of being filmed or have given anyone permission to film the crowd while checking them. The two men were sentenced to a combined 42 months at Inner London Crown Court on April the 24th. Dennis of Ennis Creeches Way, Little Hampton, previously pleaded guilty to conspiracy possession of a controlled drug, received he received a 20-month sentence, suspended for 2 years, as well as 120 hours on paid work and attendance to a rehab program. Both men are also subject to a 9-year sexual harm prevention order. It prohibits them from entering any swimming pool or changing rooms and from contacting each other or communicating with known sex offenders. It also prohibits them from sharing any images showing the genitals of any woman or female child via the internet or file sharing application. Investigating Officer Detective Sergeant Claire Jackson Harwood said, "This has been a long-running investigation with officers working tirelessly to ensure the victims get the justice they deserve. Dennis and Morgan's insidious actions will have a lifelong impact on the victims who were preyed upon while they enjoyed a hobby. They have given no thought to the victim and simply acted for their own gratification. Not satisfied with just recording the images, they have worked together to go on and create profile documents and research their victims on social media. These actions make this offending even more shocking. I hope this outcome gives the victim the closure they deserve. What do you think, listeners? Leave your comments, your thoughts and feelings about this newsreel via email address risingaboveshadowsofabuse@gmail.com. Thank you. Our next newsreel is from the Guardian newspapers by Sarah Johnson, Monday, the 29th of April, 2024. The man who repairs women on rape as a weapon and how the world forgot the Democratic Republic of Congo. For the Nobel laureate, Denis Mukwege, who has treated more than 80,000 survivors of sexual violence by armed groups, the West displayed double standards over the stain on our humanity. Walking around a camp for displaced people in Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo this year, the Nobel Peace Laureate, Dr. Denis Mukwege, was filled with shame. Around him were women, many of them survivors of rape, living in destitution with no access to clean water or to any protection. The women had left their homes after fighting between the Congolese army and the M23 rebel group resumed in North Kivu province 3 years ago. Since then, aid agencies have reported an increase in sexual violence in the region. In April last year, the medical charity Médecins Sans Frontières said it was treating 48 new survivors a day among the displaced people living in camps around the city of Goma. The situation of women and young girls in Goma is a stain on our humanity, the renowned gynecologist says. I think we should all feel ashamed to see these women abandoned. The more time goes by, the more atrocities we see. It's hard to understand why people behave the way they do when it comes to sexual violence of this kind. Known as the man who repairs women, Mukwege, 69, has treated more than 80,000 survivors of sexual violence by armed groups at Panzi Hospital, which he founded in Bukavu, South Kivu, in 1999. In 2018, along with the Yazidi activist Nadia Murad, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for his work, which he dedicated to sexual violence survivors across the world. In his Nobel lecture, he talked about the first patients admitted to the hospital. One had been raped and shot in her genitals. Another was an 18-month-old baby horrifically injured by rape. The macabre violence knew no limit, he said at the time. That violence has never stopped. Every day, between 5 and 7 new survivors of rape come through the doors of the hospital. Raping a woman, the children, and hurting them and showing it to the community is a way of traumatizing everyone, says Mukwege, who, with Murad, set up the Global Survivors Fund to provide reparation for victims. I think sexual violence is a formidable weapon of war, but we are not yet doing enough to stop it, he says. Sexual violence is a red line that should not be crossed in conflict, and if it is crossed, the world should react together and be able to say, no, this is not acceptable. DRC has experienced 3 decades of conflict with militias and groups of bandits emerging from the two civil wars fought between 1996 and 2003. The east of the country has borne the brunt of the fighting. More than 100 armed groups now operate there. Among them is a resurgent M23, which the UN says is backed up by neighboring Rwanda, a claim Kigali denies. Since 2021, about 1.7 million people have fled fighting linked to the group in North Kivu, and hundreds of thousands of people are living in overcrowded camps in Goma and the surrounding areas. Mukwege has been critical of the Congolese government's response to the fighting, denouncing its impunity over war crimes and crimes against humanity and the plundering of the country's natural resources. His comments have brought him enemies, and he narrowly survived an assassination attempt in 2012. For a time, he was under UN protection, but that ended in 2020. In December, he ran in the presidential election. I wanted to take my responsibility before history, he says. And we try to offer an alternative vision to say that there is no fatality, the possibility of changing things. Mukwege took about 1% of the vote, and the incumbent, Felix Tshisekedi, won a second term in office in a vote that 9 opposition candidates condemned as a sham. Mukwege, who has been nominated for the Aurora Humanitarian Prize, announced next month, has campaigned around the world for survivors of gender-based violence, and last month he joined the Eldest, an independent group of global leaders working for peace and human rights, founded by Nelson Mandela. The DRC, he feels, has been abandoned by the international community. The UN peacekeeping mission, MONUSCO, which has operated in DRC for more than 2 decades, is due to leave by the end of this year. In 2022, more than 30 people died during protests in the eastern provinces, calling for the forces' immediate withdrawal for its failure to protect civilians. Imagine to withdraw after 20 years in the field, living an aggression where war crimes and crimes against humanity are committed on a daily basis. What should our feeling towards the international community be? It's a feeling of abandonment, he says. I'd like the Congolese to feel solidarity from the international community because they are human beings and they need that solidarity. Mukwege says many nations are reluctant to involve themselves in the country's affairs for fear of harming their economic interests. DRC has vast mineral riches and is the world's leading supplier of cobalt, a crucial component in smartphones and electric vehicles. It's amazing that economic interests can take precedence over humanity. I find it sad to say, but it's as if in the DRC, the illegal exploitation of minerals for green energy, in fact, spills blood, he says. He wants the international community to ditch double standards in prioritizing the crisis in Ukraine and Gaza over that of the DRC. We're experiencing almost the same tragedy as those taking place in the Middle East and Ukraine, but nobody is talking about the DRC, or very little, he says. Despite this, Mukwege retain and will continue to fight for those who suffer. I have hope, he says, because I am convinced that the victims who are suffering today will be able to take their destiny into their own hands and put an end to all the injustice. We're experiencing here. What are your thoughts about this particular newsreel? Do you think the international body is sidelining the DRC, that is Democratic Republic of Congo, because it's an African country? Just like Mukwege pointed out, that what is happening in the Middle East as well as Ukraine is similar to what is happening in DRC. Listeners, what do you think? Leave your comments, thoughts, and feelings via email address, risingaboveshadowsofabuse@gmail.com. Thank you. BBC News by Tyson Cotter and Tamasin Ford. BBC Africa, BBCI, McKenney and London. April 29th, 2024. Sierra Leone's president Julius Maada Bio took the bold step of declaring a national emergency over rape and sexual violence in 2019. 5 years on, BBC Africa Eye explores whether survivors of attacks are getting justice. In the city of Makeni, a three-hour drive east of Sierra Leone's capital, Freetown, a young mother sits outside her home with her three-year-old daughter. Anita, which is not her real name, describes the day in June 2023 when she found her toddler with blood dripping from her nappy. I worked for this woman and she gave me an errand that Saturday morning to go to the market. She explained that she left her child with her employer and her 22-year-old son. He took my child, he said, to buy sweets and biscuits for her. It was a lie. When she got back, she realized her daughter was missing. After searching for her for some time, they were used by the 22-year-old mother who see the toddler was bleeding. She took her to the hospital, and after two rounds of stitches, it was confirmed she had been raped. The nurses began checking the child, and they said, "Oh my God, what has this man done to this child?" The doctor who was treating my child even cried. Anita went to the police, but the man fled, and a year on, the police have not been able to find him. The president created a law so that whoever rapes children should be arrested and sent to jail, she says. Angry that nothing appears to have been done, she is referring to a tougher sexual offenses law created 5 years ago after President Maada Bio declared the emergency over rape. It followed protests in December 2018 when hundreds of people wearing a white t-shirt emblazoned with the words "Hands off our girls" marching through Freetown. News of another child had shocked the nation, a five-year-old girl who was left paralyzed from the waist down. It was reported at the time that the cases of sexual violence had almost doubled within a year, a third involving children. Sierra Leoneans have had enough. The four-month-long state of emergency from February 2019 allowed the president to divert state resources into tracking sexual violence. An updated Sexual Offences Act brought in stricter penalties for sexual assault. Rape sentences were increased to a minimum of 15 years or life if it involved a child. The Sexual Offences Model Court to fast-track trials was created in Freetown the following year. There appears to have been some progress. Reported cases of sexual and gender-based violence have gone down by almost 17%, from just over 12,000 in 2018 to just over 10,000 in 2023, according to police statistics. Creating increased awareness and new structures is one thing, but making sure that people like Anita's daughter get justice is another. The Rainbow Initiative is a national charity that works with survivors of sexual violence. It says that in 2022, just 5% of the 2,705 cases it handled made it to the High Court. One of the issues in the resources available to those who are supposed to enforce the law. At the police station in Makeni, where Anita reported her daughter's rape, Assistant Superintendent Abu Bakar Kanu, who leads the Family Support Unit, FSU, says they get around 4 cases of child sexual assault each week. The big challenge his team faces is the lack of transport to physically go and arrest suspects. He coordinates all 7 police divisions in the region, and between them, they do not have a single vehicle. There are times the suspect is available, but because of lack of vehicles, you can't reach that suspect to arrest him, says Assistant Superintendent Kanu. Doing the right thing at the right time is a challenge. Like many in Sierra Leone, he was impressed with the government action that followed the state of emergency. We have enough good laws and policy, but the structure and personnel are the challenge for us to holistically address the issues of sexual and gender-based violence in Sierra Leone. Even if an alleged perpetrator is apprehended, to get them before a judge is an even bigger struggle. In order for the case against the rape suspect to be heard, there is only one person in the country who can sign the documents, the Attorney General. It was meant to speed up the process and get the case straight to the courts, but it has created a different bottleneck. Presently, it is not possible to have any other law officer or any other counsel to sign an indictment for sexual-related offenses, says State Counsel Joseph A.K. Sese, a lawyer employed by the government. The 2019 amendment stipulates it is only the Attorney General that can rightly sign an indictment. So that has been posing a challenge when it comes to getting the indictments to court. Information Minister Chenol Barr admits this is not a perfect process, but says it's a process that will continue to improve on. Challenged on the question that many believe little has changed when it comes to getting justice for rape survivors, he acknowledged that in some communities, people feel that way, but he rejects the idea that there has been no progress. I think the systemic reforms that we've put in place are there. The new laws are there. And those steps, I think, have led to the overall feeling that we are not in the deep, dark days of 2019. For Anita, back in Makeni, it has been nearly a year since her toddler was raped. She has had no new information from the police, so has resorted to posting the alleged suspect's photo on Facebook. I want people to help me search for the boy. I'm tormented and I'm not happy. What has happened to my child? I don't want it to happen to any other child. This is horrendous. Do you think the law is helping sexual violence survivors? Are rapists getting away with rape? What can be done to bring justice? As relate to this perpetrator of sexual assault. you have suggestions or recommendations, please leave your views, your thoughts, and feelings about this particular newsreel via email address risingabovesshadowsofabuse@gmail.com. Thank you. The Guardian, 24th of April, 2024, by Rory Carroll, Ireland correspondent. Jeffrey Donaldson has appeared in court, charged with rape, gross indecency, and other sexual offences spanning 21 years in a case that has stunned Northern Ireland. His wife, Eleanor Donaldson, appeared alongside him at Newry Magistrate Court in County Down on Wednesday and was charged with aiding and abetting rape and indecent assault. Donaldson, 61, charges one count of rape, one count of gross indecency towards a child, and nine counts of indecent assault on a female from 1985 to the allegations relate to two complainants. The former Democratic Unionist Party, DUP, leader said nothing as he passed a throng of police and media in his first public appearance since 28th of March, when he was arrested and questioned with his wife. Both deny the allegations. The rape charge alleges Donaldson had unlawful sexual intercourse with the alleged victim without her consent on a date unknown between 1985 and 1991. Nine allegations of indecent assault span 1985-2006. He's also charged with committing an act of gross indecency towards a child between 2005 and 2006. Eleanor Donaldson, 8, is charged with aiding and abetting the offences and with two counts of cruelty. The charges span 1985 to 2004. The couple appeared in the dock separated by a custody officer while the charges were read during a 7-minute hearing in a small crowded courtroom. They spoke only to confirm their names, date of birth, and that they understood the charges. Donaldson, wearing a gray suit, had his arm folded and appeared impassive. No pleas were taken. Judge Amon King released the couple on continuing bail fixed at £350. The couple, who married in 1987, are represented by different legal firms. They are to have no contact with witnesses. King warned people in the court not record or post video or audio of the proceedings. The case will return to the magistrate's court on the 22nd of May to fix a timetable. The defendants will not be obliged to attend that hearing. The hearing was the first step in what is expected to be a lengthy legal process, not helped by a backlog of cases in the courts that will continue into next year. The Police Service of Northern Ireland said a complaint in early March prompted the investigation that led to the Donaldson's arrest, which caused a political earthquake in Northern Ireland. Donaldson stepped down from the DUP leadership, but remains an MP. The party appointed the East Belfast MP, Gavin Robinson, as interim leader. In February, Donaldson had won widespread praise and bolstered his authority by agreeing a deal with Downing Street on post-Brexit trading arrangements that ended a 2-year DUP boycott of power sharing and revived the stormont executive and assembly he had been expected to lead his party into the general election. Born into a Presbyterian family in the fishing village of Kilkeel, Donaldson was a full-time political activist from the age of 18, serving apprenticeships with Enoch Powell and James Bolinox of the Ulster Unionist Party before defecting to the DUP in 2003. He was knighted in 2016 and became party leader in 2021. What are your thoughts about this particular newsreel? Kindly leave your comments and views via email address rightnaboshadowsofabuse@gmail.com. Independent Newspapers, Friday, 19th of April, 2024. Federal prosecutors want to revoke the U.S. citizenship of a South African man convicted of killing two Alaska Native women for allegedly lying on his naturalization application for saying he had neither killed nor hurt anyone. The man, Brian Stephen Smith, 52, was convicted earlier this year in the deaths of the two women, narrating as he recorded one woman dying. That video was stored on a phone that was stolen from his pickup. The images were transferred to a memory card and later turned over to the police by the person who took the phone. Smith lied when he responded to questions on the naturalization application, asking whether he had been involved in the killing or badly hurting or sexually assaulting someone. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Alaska said in a statement on Friday. Smith answered no to those questions, but prosecutors say he had committed the two murders that involved torture and sexual assault by the time he completed the application, officials said. If convicted of illegally obtaining naturalization, his U.S. citizenship will be revoked. No court date has been set. An email seeking comment sent to Smith's public defender was not immediately returned. Smith was convicted in the deaths of Catherine Henry, 30, whose body was found weeks after Smith recorded her death in September 2019 at Tunnel Place Suites by Marriott, a hotel in Midtown Anchorage, where he worked. Smith, who came to Alaska in 2014, became a naturalized citizen the same month Henry was killed. The other victim was Veronica Abutrok, who died in either 2018 or 2019. Smith told police that he picked her up while his wife was out of town. When she refused to shower, he shot her in the head and dumped her body north of Anchorage. He told police where the body was left, and authorities later found his skull with a bullet wound there. Smith was convicted February the 22nd after the Anchorage jury deliberated less than 2 hours. Smith's sentencing was set for two consecutive Fridays, July the 12th and July the 19th. Alaska does not have the death penalty. What are your views about this particular newsroom? Please leave your comments, thoughts and feelings via email address, risingaboveshadowsofabuse@gmail.com. Thank you. The Guardian Newspapers. By Eromo Egbejule, 18th of April, 2024. Nigerian troops, Lydia Simon, recovered along with three children born in captivity, was one of the 276 schoolgirls taken in 2014. Nigerian troops have rescued a pregnant woman and her three children 10 years after she was abducted by Boko Haram militants when she was a schoolgirl in the town of Chibok. Lydia Simon was rescued in Waza Council area, about 95 miles, 150 kilometers east of Chibok, from where 276 schoolgirls were seized in April 2014. As many as 82 are still missing, a decade after the high-profile mass kidnapping. Announcing the news on Thursday, the Nigerian Army did not give details of the rescue other than to say Simon was found in the community of Ngoshe. Chibok and Ngoshe are in Borno State, birthplace of the 15-year-old insurgency that has since spread to neighboring Cameroon, Chad, and Niger, uprooting about 2 million people across the region. The army statement said Simon was 5 months pregnant It was accompanied by a picture of her and her three children born in captivity, who appeared to be between the ages of 2 and 4. She has yet to be reunited with her family. The Chibok abduction was the first of a series of mass school kidnapping in Nigeria. Shocking the world and triggering a global social media campaign tagged hashtag Bring Back Our Girls. 10 years on, many of the adoptees, now adults, have been freed or escaped, but jihadist groups and bandits continue to target schools for mass abductions. Since the Chibok attack, more than 2,190 students have been kidnapped, according to the Lagos-based geopolitical risk consultancy SBM Intelligence. It said mass abductions had become an increasingly favorite spot for Nigeria's teeming armed groups. As many as 57 of the women from Chibok escaped in the hours after their kidnapping by jumping off the trucks used to abduct them. In May 2017, 82 others were released after the government reportedly paid $1 million ransoms. Those who returned in recent years were mostly found abandoned in the forests. Some Chibok parents and security analysts have said there is little evidence to show there is a special military operation to free the remaining women. It is not known if they are all still alive. Some of the recently freed women were either raped by the insurgents or forced into marriages, according to Chioma Aguegbo, an activist who was part of the hashtag Bring Back Our Girls campaign. We have heard their stories about the amount of trauma and violence they have faced. Somebody who was kidnapped 10 years ago is not returning as the same person, Aguegbo told Associated Press. The cause has largely been forgotten by many of the politicians and celebrities who championed it. On 14th of April, the anniversary of the abduction, the local activist collective that began the campaign and held rallies for years in Abuja, the Nigerian capital, said it was still seeking justice for the missing women after this decade of shame. Simon's rescue was symbolic of the enduring hope that pervaded her hometown, said the Abuja-based analyst Hidayat Hassan, a non-resident fellow with the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. It's symbolic that 10 years after, we still got another of the girls, Hassan said. It keeps our hope alive. Simon's family are waiting to be reunited with their long-lost relative, as are the villagers of Chibok. The government has not told us anything, and we are waiting for an official call, said Yakubu Nkeki, the chair of the Chibok Girls Parents Association. This is so sad. 10 years onwards, one of the Chibok girls returned, traumatized, I believe, with three children and a fourth pregnancy. What does that say about the security in that region, as well as the state of our leadership in Nigeria? This This is food for thought. Listeners and viewers, what do you think about this particular newsreel? Leave your comments, thoughts, feelings, and emotions via our email address, risingaboveshadowsofabuse@gmail.com. That will be all for today as relates to world news and abuse. Listeners and viewers, be safe and be positive. Thank you. And see you on the next episode. Thank you and bye for now.